It's Monday morning. My name is Keith Brown-Eal. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. Last month, we had a call-in show that was quite lively, and we felt it important to keep the dialogue going on race, police brutality, and personal responsibility. On today's edition, host David Bell talks with Cardell, a student at UMKC, and Zero Profit of the Ida B. Wells Coalition Against Racism and Police Brutality. We will open the phone lines for you to make comments and ask questions. Please make your comments and keep them respectful and to the point so that we may answer as many calls as possible. There will be no calendar of events this week, but we will play the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Stay tuned for David Bell and his guests.
Good morning. My name is David Bell, and we're here today on Jaws of Justice. This is part two of a call-in show that we did on race. And the last show, we talked about what communities are saying behind closed doors. We talked about Eric Gardner, Michael Brown, and Tamir Rice. And we looked for a common thread among the three. If you'll recall, we removed the size of Mr. Gardner. We removed the convenience store confrontation of Mr. Brown and the use of drugs added near the time of the shooting. And when we took away all of that, all what we considered aggregating factors, we were left only with a small child, which then left us with Mr. Rice. And so we were helped by a psychologist, Melissa Hasley, to look for the common thread of the African-American male being viewed as something other than human, super strength, super aggressiveness, etc., something that can take a jaywalking stop or selling loose cigarettes or even the waving of a toy gun all the way to a shooting, which can then appear justified to certain members of society. And so today we seek to understand the perspective of Mr. Gardner, Mr. Brown, and Mr. Rice, the perspective of the individuals that must constantly confront the images being projected onto them by others. How does it affect them? And if it does affect them, then what do we do about it and what's next? Our guests today are Cordell Pulliam, who goes by CJ, who's a University of Missouri, Kansas City student. He's an active member of many student organizations, including Men of Color, the African American Student Union, and the mock trial team. We also have Not For Profit, a.k.a. Zero Profit. His nom de guerre was born in Ponce, Puerto Rico, and raised in East Harlem and South Bronx in New York City. He's a community activist, underground hip-hop MC, graffiti writer, and self-described vandal, actor, and the founder of the art and agitation collective AGIT, All Ghetto Indigenous Tribe Army. He's also a member of the Black Autonomy Federation and the Ida B. Wells Coalition. Zero Profit, welcome to the show.
Hey, greetings.
And CJ, Cordell Pulliam, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning. My first question to both of you, and I'll start with Zero Profit, is what are these preconceived notions? Have you been subjected to them? We'll start with that.
Well, yeah. In New York City, in Harlem specifically, there is basically cops on every corner. And it's interesting because cops are not there to protect any of the people who live there. They're there to protect the new gentrifiers, who generally tend to be white people. And their perception is that you're entering into sort of a jungle or a really dangerous place. And so there's always that perception. So, you know, whenever you walk into stores, whenever you walk down the street, and you always have this idea that you're being somehow profiled, you're being somehow targeted and seen as a certain thing that's based on, you know, all kinds of things, you know. And kind of the code word today, I think, for you know, anti-black is to say it's hip-hop. So it's hip-hop people dress a certain way. Hip-hop people act a certain way. So whether you're talking about, you know, a kid wearing a hoodie, you know, or, you know, or having baggy pants, and those are all, you know, things that you can look at and say, well, he was shot because he was wearing a hoodie, so it makes him look like a criminal. But it's a code word for anti-black.
So being watched, being targeted, is one of the things that you said that you've dealt with. CJ, what about yourself?
I don't get a lot of targeting personally, but I do. I mean, like, I have brothers, I have cousins who get a lot of that. I think that the biggest trouble spot that we deal with is the preconceived notions that people think of when they see black men. I think historically, you know, like you said, the superhuman strength and things of that nature come from the myth of the black man, this Mandingo culture. The black man is strong, he is virile, he is large. I mean, and I think that's, you know, comes from, like, it's deeply entrenched in slave culture, it's deeply entrenched in the portrayal of blackface and in the media, you know. And even in ourselves, we like this hard exterior. We're hard, we're strong. So we perpetuate all of these stereotypes, and, you know, it feeds into this, you know, fear the black man kind of thing.
And so, and by the way, ladies and gentlemen, this is a call-in show, 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. And so, going back to you, Zero Profit, if you're in an area, in a store, you know that people are looking at you, you've come in wearing a hoodie, you maybe dress differently than the other shoppers there at the store, and you know, or at least you feel like you're being watched or targeted as someone who's about to commit a criminal act solely by how you look. How does that make you feel, number one? And then second, does that ever manifest itself in your behavior itself? Meaning, are you affected in some manner to such an extent by how you're viewed that you act upon those feelings or that view?
Well, I think initially it's affecting you in such a way that you feel very uncomfortable, but at a certain point it becomes a need for defiance, a kind of defiance.
Explain that to me.
So, I mean, a lot of times it's like, okay, well, if you're going to treat us this way, then we're going to be, you know, like Ice Cube said, the N-word you love to hate. You know, and we start to understand that our defiance or our resistance is a political act.
When you say political act, what do you mean by that?
I mean, we can just react to life, and we can just succumb to it, and we can succumb to oppression, and we can succumb to racism, and we can succumb to injustice, or we can act upon it, and we can fight back. And so at a certain point, we start to understand that anything we do that is not acceptable to them is a political act. It's a political action, in fact.
But are you saying that you will almost wanting to or actually do engage in the very behaviors that the others are looking at you to engage in, and as an act of defiance?
Well, I mean, I think our understanding is that we're not really engaging in anything that's wrong, and we're doing what we do, and they have a certain perception of it. You know, the brother who was chokehold in New York was, you know, the grounds for killing him was that he was selling illegal cigarettes. So, you know, the argument could be like, well, he was doing something illegal. He was doing something that's wrong. But basically, he was just surviving. So we understand the difference between surviving and being illegal.
And CJ, for yourself, talking from the perspective of, and again, you know, CJ's not talking for every black man, and Zero Profit's not talking for every Puerto Rican man, and I'm not talking for every white man, but it is what it is, and we're here.
Mm-hmm.
But CJ, from the perspective of black male, and you've talked about historically, does the viewpoint of this other, this society, this greater society looking in on a black male, does that view that I've expressed before that you've talked about, does that affect the black male himself? Does he then create a culture or create something around that viewpoint to take ownership of it?
I think so. I think that in part we do our best to embody that. We feed into it, you know, everything that they say about us, we kind of feed into. We like, I mean, it's a nice image, I think, in some, it's a hyper-masculine kind of culture, and I think that at to a point, we love to embody that. We have a real cool kind of image, and it's hard, and it's kind of like untouchable. We don't like to be approached. It's kind of like an unapproachable thing, and I think that, I mean, even amongst black people to other black people, like as a black man to a black man, we don't always like to approach each other. We come up to each other tense. So, I mean, I can that kind of hypermasculine creates that kind of thing.
But when you and I were talking on the phone yesterday,
mm-hmm.
you said the hypermasculinity comes about from a historical standpoint as mm-hmm. well, from within the black community. Could you speak to that briefly?
Throughout history here in America, the black man has dealt with so much emasculation and a deconstruction of his own family and everything that he holds dear. I think that the hardness that exists in a black man comes from, you know, being taken from his family, being forced to work against his will, being used as a mule to be married off, having no will of his own. And once he was granted freedom, all the work that it took to get that, he could be stolen away from his home and hung just for being successful, for looking at the wrong person. And then when he did get right, you had to pass tests and go and jump through all these hoops. And still, every chance you got, you're being told to lay down. So at some point, I think that the hypermasculinity comes about, you know, we have to stand up, being not being ashamed to stand up and not being proud. And to do that, you have to be strong. We are forced to take on roles earlier than we need to. We are forced to become men so fast because the world doesn't leave the opportunity for us to be innocent. We don't come into the world with a sense of, you know, with a sense of wonder. We come in with a sense of reality. We're warned from the jump that we are black, and that is something that we need to know before we go out into the world, that the world doesn't accept that. And because of that, we're instantly coming hard. We're coming in scared, and we need to be strong in order to deal with that.
And so, go ahead, Zero Problem.
Yeah, I just want to say, I saw this study where they found that white people had a perception of black kids as being much older than they actually are, and that was used as a justification for handcuffing little elementary school kids and, you know, mistreating them and treating them like adults, but they were 6 years old.
And so Zero Profit, I know the last show we talked, when we talk about race, a lot of times it's white and black. You represent another minority, if you will, at least for this radio show, Puerto Rican. I don't know if we could generalize it even more to Latino male. Is that correct or no?
Not really so much as a Latino male, because statistically Puerto Ricans fall into the so-called African-American range in terms of, you know, prison population, in terms of unemployment and all kinds of things. There was actually a few years ago when there was a study of all these statistics for all the different ills of society, and this one Latino, Chicano politician from California pointed out that if you removed Puerto Ricans from the statistics of Latinos, then Latinos wouldn't be shown to be faring so badly. So I think we're coming from the African diaspora as far as our view and our treatment in this society. Where, you know, the Latino is kind of a construct based on a people who were colonized by people who spoke Spanish. But statistically, it almost doesn't exist.
All right. And so if we go back then, if we Zero Profit, CJ, if we talk about this hypermasculinity, which we're talking about affecting African-American population, which we're talking about subsuming within that population that you're talking about, Zero Profit, then isn't there some reality then? Isn't there something based in reality that a fear of a black male? Meaning, CJ, you're talking from the perspective of, from a historical perspective, the black male had to stand up, had to face reality, had to become almost, and I'm using the word hyper-masculinity, I don't know a better phrase for it, also become, you know, more than human in order to be able to withstand and survive through all the crap that he had to go through, whether once he was released from actual bondage slavery and then through Reconstruction and onward into essentially another type of slavery in the criminal justice system. Isn't there a reality then there when someone views the black male as something greater than human or stronger than human?
No, I think in reality, no matter what we try to embody, we are still human. I think that there is an inherent sense of needing to check the black man that exists in the culture just period. They have been checked, like a physical or a need to like humble that person has been ingrained in society for so long. I don't think the last 30 years can erase that, you know? And so like when you see a black man successful or even like that, like you assume they assume that it's affirmative action. I mean, they find so many ways to discredit him. They find so many ways to bring him low. I don't think that the fear is based on the hypermasculinity by itself, but the fear is based on just seeing that becoming a reality.
And at the same time, if the police force has a fear of black men, then they have no business being in the black community policing it.
Well, and so that's a good point. That gets us back to what we're here about in terms of this second show on race, and particularly focusing on Mr. Garner, Mr. Brown, and Tamir Rice, and how the different components of society view what happened. And again, this is a call-in show. We're taking calls at 816-931-5534. Please call in if you have any comments. And so I guess, but the issue is that if this viewpoint of the black male, it was used as an example, is ingrained in society to such an extent, then how is it that you would find police officers that wouldn't be subjected to that viewpoint?
I mean, in New York, we're talking about a few things. We're talking about community control of the police. We're also talking about abolition of the police. You know, we're also talking about making it a guideline of being a police officer where you have to live in the community that you police. So obviously, if you're, you know, if you're living in Harlem, or you're living in the Bronx, or you're living in, you know, in a black neighborhood in Kansas City, your neighbors are the people that you're actually working with, and you know them, and you know that they're not, you know, this image that you've created, or that capitalism has created, or that this society has created. You know, somebody, I think it might have been Huey Newton, was saying that, you know, black people were brought over here to serve a purpose as slaves, you know. But what do you do with the people once you've abolished slavery, once you no longer have a need for them? And this country is trying to basically snuff them out. And if you can't snuff them out, you keep them in place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he was just talking about, you know, historically, I mean, the emasculation of the black man. You know, so the idea is, okay, let's find ways to keep them in place. Let's find, you know, dare I say it, you know, this society looks at the weak person as the person who gets effed. You know, mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So, okay, a woman is weak because she's the one that gets effed. You know, a gay man is weak because he's the one that gets effed. And so the idea is to emasculate the black male to make him the one that's constantly being screwed. You know, and that's what's going on. And it's like, so if you fight back, they have to find a way to emasculate you. If they can't emasculate you, they can put you in prison. If they can't put you in prison, they can kill you.
CJ, I heard you respond to that. What thoughts do you have?
A fireman, let's keep this in context. A fireman fears death. He fears the fire, but he still has a job to do. As a police officer, you are trained. You go through copious amounts of training. You're constantly trained to keep a level head and approach these situations in a certain way. And to say that if you can be taken out of your training and your job to approach a situation where you react in a way that a police officer should not. We look specifically at that Michael Brown situation. No matter what happened in that situation, it's not procedure to leave a body out in the sun for that long and not cover it. It's not procedure to put that same body into an unmarked car instead of a CSI vehicle to wrap that body properly or any of those things. That procedure is not followed. You have a job. No matter what the race issues are, you have a job to do and you fail at that. I don't think the police part of this is not about being afraid. It's about control. It's about social control. I think that in culture, the predominant culture, the Caucasian culture, has made the black man strong. You force us to work in the fields. Our bodies are amazingly built to handle this pressure and these kind of things, and they fear that. You see the hyper athlete, the people that you idolize. You will watch football every week and idolize a black man. At the same time, fear one when you see one in person. When one walks by your car, you lock your door. Because you know that I feel like to a certain extent in culture, you understand that you have wronged this individual, that you feel some kind of white guilt. And seeing that for yourself and dealing with that personally affects you in that way.
All right. Well, thank you. We've got a call right now, and I want to respond to that, CJ, but we've got a call right now. Caller, you're on the air. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Lenexa, Kansas.
Yes, and what's your comment?
Well, you know, it just seems to me, I'm 65 years old. I was involved with the civil rights stuff as a kid. I was 15 when it was 1965 and all the stuff that was achieved then. But I got to tell you, you look at the culture, and to me, I believe that minority cultures, both Latino and African American, I mean, they work every day to make sure that their image, this thug image, a lot of this is out there. Now, certainly don't mean everybody, but I work in the inner city. I see plenty of young people come by there, and I've learned not to make an opinion about them, how they're, how they look, because when they start talking to you, they're as graceful and polite as they could be. But if I could get everybody in a room, I'd say, look, we want there's jobs out there. There's people that people of all cultures need jobs. But we only hire people that we're not afraid of, and we only hire people that we're not, that we feel we can work with. So I believe this hanging on to this thug image, and I mean no disrespect for that, it's what it looks like to me. When you look like you want to be tough and you wear your hoodie into the store, then to me, you're trying to perpetuate an image. You may be cold. Your ears may be cold, but you're trying to perpetuate an image. Thank you for listening.
Caller, thank you. Let me summarize a little bit what CJ said with Zero Profit, so then I want to respond to that caller. I think Zero Profit, when you were talking about, you know, this, you were citing someone talking about No Place for the Black Man. CJ, you were talking about black men having to be strong, working in the fields, you know, work to death almost. You had to be strong to survive. We moved to the present. And then the only permissible place for the very strong black man that is viewed with some type of okay by society is on the playing field. But if you step outside of that image for a second and you project some type of strongness or some type of strength, then we go back to Zero Profit saying we're going to emasculate you, and if that doesn't work, we're going to put you in prison. If that doesn't work, we're going to kill you. Do I have that right so far? Is that a proper summation? And then, but the next thing I want to go to the caller and I want you guys to address is this. Real quick, what is it? And I don't know what the caller was talking about, but let's just talk about the baggy jeans, which seems to be brought up a lot. Why does baggy jeans in and of itself have to suggest thug or violence? Meaning, why isn't that just another way of dressing, right? Or why isn't a hoodie just another way of dressing? So I'm in a suit and tie today. That could be viewed to a certain extent by individuals that have been harmed by people wearing suit and tie as threatening or violent. But yet, why do we have this image of the hoodie or the baggy jeans as such? And then you've got additional comments here, Prophet.
Well, I mean, hip-hop culture that's been around for about 40 years is understood to be a culture that came out of the black ghetto. And so there's all these, you know, codes for what is hip-hop culture and the perception that is thuggery. You know, but it's funny because I went to see the movie Selma the other day, and I'm watching a bunch of black folks on the screen wearing suits and with little short haircuts. You know, they're all proper. They're in suits. They're looking good. Their ties are nice and tight, and they're wearing proper shoes that are shined, and they're still having their heads beat in by the police, by white people. You know, so I think that saying that looking like a thug or wearing a hoodie or wearing baggy pants or wearing sneakers or wearing a baseball cap is all just an excuse to keep certain people in place, you know. But, you know, somebody can go into a store and it's cold and it's wintertime and they're wearing a hoodie for the Kansas City Royals and nobody has a problem with it, you know.
CJ, you had a comment, and then we've got a caller.
Yeah, I have to agree. I don't think the clothes necessarily are the issue. I think it's the people in the clothes, because if I wear a hoodie and I deal with things, I think I'm very much seen as a non-threatening black, and they are out, you know, there's a such thing as a non-threatening black. So if I wear the same outfit, well, I'm probably not going to sag, but I'm not going to be viewed as the same thing. So I don't think it's about the clothes. It's about the way that person is walking. It's about the person. The clothes don't make that issue. But speaking on the clothes, you have to even think about how economically black people are stunted, and this is what we have to work with, and we're going to do the best we can. And also, we have to remember that blacks aren't in control of the media. The media is controlled by people in corporations. And that being said, that's the thing that's being put out there for black people to see every day. And these are things that young black people are going to emulate and try to be like the people that they love and want to be like. Girls have weaves because they want to be like Beyonce. They sag like the rappers that they idolize who have had the same kind of life as them and have been able to overcome that life through hip-hop. And so they feel like that's a way for them to overcome. I think the entirety of our message has always been about overcoming. No matter what, we have many rivers, many roads to climb, and many hills to climb. And I think that's prevalent. And so we're always looking for ways to continue to do that as society continues to change. And I think the most acceptable way that we see today is entertainment. Athletes, basketball, be good at basketball, be good at singing, be a performer. And that's the emulation that you get. The sagging is popular because it became popular in gangster rap culture in the late 80s, early 90s. And so it continues to be that way a little bit in hip hop dress. We see some differentials in that, but that's the main one that we see perpetuated for people that we relate to when we listen to hip hop.
We have a caller. Oh, I guess we don't call it. So really quickly then, with regard to that, and we'll take a break here in a sec, but I guess what I want to go towards is, why is sagging or a hoodie, why is that perceived as any more threatening than someone in a Jimmy Buffett uniform, like with cut-off jeans and flip-flops?
But I mean, it's like he was saying, it's actually the person wearing it. It's just a code for black. You know, it's a code for a people that you don't want here.
So what? So all right. So you've seen me. What if I go in with the hoodie that you're wearing, Zero Profit, right now, and saggy jeans? So what does that mean? Am I going to be a non-threatening?
No, you're not.
What I guess Caucasian male.
You're going to be a Caucasian male, which is what you are right now, and what you are no matter what you're wearing. There's a perception. There was a former black political prisoner called Albert Washington. He said black is a political condition. And I think this system understands that black is a political condition, and they're responding to you as something that's not supposed to be here. They're responding to you as something that has to be held down. They're responding to you as something that has to be snuffed. You know, one of the things about hip-hop culture is that it insinuated itself not only on this society but on internationally. And basically that was, you know, folks saying, you know what, we're going to find another way to overcome. You know, so a lot of folks within hip hop culture, within entertainment, realize, you know, that you don't necessarily have to march in the streets. You don't necessarily have to, you know, sing "We Shall Overcome." You know, because if you continue to sing "We Shall Overcome," you might be overcome. You know, and Malcolm X said, you know, it's time to stop singing and start swinging. Okay. And I think hip hop culture has realized that you, in some ways, you can have it both ways. And I think the system fears that. You know, this system does have a fear of a black planet.
You know, I'm here with our guest today, CJ and Zero Profit. At this point, we're going to take a break and then continue with callers. Again, this is a call-in show. We are live this morning, Monday morning. It's now 9:25. The phone number 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534. We'll be right back after the break. Good morning. My name is David Bell. It's about 9:27. We're here on Jaws of Justice Radio on a Monday morning and we're joined by two guests, Zero Profit and CJ. We've been talking about, and this is part two of our show on race, and the way in which individuals who are seen in a certain way react to that viewpoint, react to how they're being viewed by the dominant culture, how they respond to it, and perhaps how they overcome it if necessary. And I guess my first question then coming after the break is it necessary to overcome? And so to a certain extent, what I'm hearing is this adoption of this hyper-masculinity is in part because of historical factors, but in part because of how society is viewed, the black male. And so if we have a situation where, I think you brought it out, Zero Profit, you want to politicize that, you want to take control of it, is that right? You want to take control of that image and make it your own? Is that what's happening when you say politicalization?
I mean, not necessarily that image, but we want to control how we are perceived and what we are, and we want to make those choices rather than having somebody make those choices for us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny because there's rampant gentrification, well, everywhere, but in East Harlem, and they asked some of the white folks who were moving into East Harlem, you know, what made you comfortable with moving into here? And they said, well, we finally ventured above, you know, 96th Street, and we saw, you know, black and Puerto Rican people with families, with small children. And they're like, oh, well, we realized they're not as dangerous as we thought they were. And next thing you know, you know, East Harlem was, you know, overrun with gentrification. So the point being that, you know, we do understand that unless we come out strong and portray ourselves as somebody you don't want to F with, you're going to get run over. And that's an understanding we have. And it's like, you know, we are human and we are, you know, and we are good people, but a lot of times, you know, sitting down and saying, you know, hands up, don't shoot, guarantees that you're going to get shot.
What, we've got a caller on the line. Caller, what's your name and where are you calling from?
My name is Laura Bryan and I'm an educator. And I have worked with preschool African American boys to high school African American young men. We are looking at a system that has demonized our young men from preschool on. When I worked at a school where they had my children standing on a line with their hands behind their back, and their feet had to be at a 45-degree angle. And if not, they were not allowed in the classroom. And I told the principal, what are you doing, preparing them for prison? Is it more important that they conform than to actually be educated? If you are not allowed in the classroom, what does that say to you? conformity is more important than your education.
So, caller, thank you very much. And I want to send that question to CJ. I guess.
And I also would like to say that that's why we as African Americans need to work with our young men and not leave it up to the education system or anyone else to educate our children.
So
we're the only race that allows that, and we need to do better on our part.
Caller, thank you very much for calling. CJ, what's your response to that? And I guess the first thing I'd ask you is this kind of teaching, I guess, young black children their place in society, if you will, is what the caller suggested. What's your comment on that?
It's absolutely 100% true. Education is amazingly important. It is the most important thing that we can do as African Americans to prepare our children for the world. Like I said, I had a parent who was very, very talkative with me about the reality of the world and what I would need to do in order to become the best that I can be, and education was a huge part of that. I think it's very disparaging how the education system treats African Americans, and I think that, you know, like the flight of Caucasians and other people from the inner city has dilapidated the entire education system that we have here and left them with very few options and leave them, and there's no child left behind. Was so funny to me because that's exactly what you did. You left them behind and moved on and sent your money to Lee Summit or Blue Springs and all these other places. And when we move out there, then it's an issue too that we're always stopped. Like when I used to walk in Raytown, like just going to work, I worked somewhere over there, I was stopped all the time. And it was always so funny to me, just walking. I was walking and stopped. I was like, you're stopping me and I'm walking. I don't know what I could be possibly doing right now. I think that there are some important initiatives out here, like Am I My Brother's Keeper and things like that, that are going to do a great part. But I think that, and this is the message to any college-educated black men that are listening, that no matter what our major is or what we're doing, we need to take some time out and teach. Like teach at schools, teach at, do some kind of teaching, hands-on work with our young African-American men, build them up, and just, like, try to let them know that what their possibilities are, because the schools aren't going to be enough. They're dilapidated. They cannot handle. And they need to know from other black men that there are possibilities, that there's something that we can do.
Zero Profit, I see you shaking your head. What's
I think it was Malcolm X that said, you know, to allow our oppressor to educate our children, we'd have to be damn fools. But one of the things we've been doing in New York is creating what we call freedom schools. And, I mean, it's a lot of legal stuff to be able to keep your children out of they schools. But so what we've done is they still go to they schools, but then after they're done with that, we have our freedom schools, which are kind of a almost like a re-education process. And, I think, we haven't sufficiently created our own infrastructures within the hood, within the ghetto, that allows us to be educating our own people and allows us to be, you know, having our own policing of our own communities. And I think we have to start talking about things like that. But, I don't know how it is in here, but in New York City, the public safety in the public schools is actually run by the police. So basically, anytime a kid gets in trouble in the public schools in New York City, the security people answer to the police, so the kid is treated as if he was did something illegal, and they're handcuffed in the schools, they're taken to the precinct, and these are 10-year-old kids.
And we begin the process. We have a caller, state your name and where are you from?
Yeah, my name is Phil. I'm from Old Lake, Kansas.
Yeah, what's your comment?
Yeah, I just want to say that I don't know how anybody expects there's going to be any kind of real change with what's going on. I mean, the civil rights movement handled what it could handle, and the way things are now is about as good as the people that control things want them to be. Those law enforcement officers wake up in the morning with the right to shoot you, you know, and people think they have rights or equal rights, forget so quickly how kids were drafted in the Vietnam War to go off and die for big business. So killing you on the street, that's nothing. You know, they're going to keep doing it, and it's sick, and it doesn't matter how bad you feel or how much you want it to change. Unless you've got money like Bill Gates or you're a big corporate entity, they're not going to allow it to happen, man. And people just continue to do it, and I'm tired of it.
Caller, thank you for your call. We've got a second caller on the phone, on the line. Caller, what's your name and where are you calling from? Caller, what's your name and where are you calling from? Let me address what I'm hearing from both of you, and it's what's interesting is, CJ, you're almost suggesting, and again, I'm going to overgeneralize, you're almost suggesting, you know, seeking education through the current system. We might have to some tweaks, some modifications to the current system, but that seems to be an answer that you're proposing to a mm-hmm. certain extent. And then you want the educated black men to then go and teach, which I understand.
Mm-hmm.
But Zero Profit, what you seem to be advocating, at least what you've talked about here, is almost creating a separate system. And so I guess from my perspective, I'm trying to understand, is there a vision of, you know, I don't know of us all walking down the street holding hands together. I'm not suggesting that. But if we're all going to be in the same society, wouldn't it be better to look at something closer to what CJ is advocating than a completely separate system? Or are you saying society is such that the idea of us having working towards CJ's vision of this, as he's professed here, is unrealistic?
I wanted to comment on what the last caller said, because I think the last caller is right on point. I think the police are doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing according to the dictates of this system. And, you know, people would say, oh, okay, reform the police, you know, change this, change that.
Yeah.
But the point being that they're doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. And I think we do need autonomous communities to help people. I mean, you know, in the hood, things are devastated. Things are in bad shape. And, you know, holding hands is not going to get it. And they did try to do that, you know, back in the day with the civil rights struggle, you know. And, you know, we do need a human rights struggle. But at this point, we need to allow people who are here only to serve a purpose that they no longer are able to serve to get free and to achieve some degree of equality and to achieve some degree of accepted humanity. And that's not going to happen by, you know, business as usual. It's just not.
We have another caller on the line. Caller, what's your name and where are you calling from?
Yeah, Melvin from Kansas City.
Melvin.
I wanted to address the dress that you were talking about, the dreadlocks and the sagging pants and that hip-hop whole scene. And I think that a lot of that is perpetuated by the peer pressure that where a young person lives. And if they have a tendency to dress like other people in a, say, for instance, the hood, they will be outcast or subject to even be jumped on. So they're somewhat pressured into looking like everyone else. So they assimilate into it. And so probably some of them maybe not even wanting to totally dress with the dreadlocks, the baggy pants, and the whole scene of that. And then basically the people that are committing crime, they dress just like that.
Right.
And case in point, the two kids that shot this girl that in Grandview over there by the water park, and you can look at their whole dress code look and dreadlocks. Two of them had dreadlocks, and the other one was the only one that was clean cut. And I wanted to see what you were commenting on about that.
Let me address that real quick, because I did see that picture in today's Kansas City Star. Caller, thank you very much for calling. You know, there's nothing, would you guys both agree with me, there's nothing inherently dangerous about dreadlocks. What's happening is when you put a picture in the newspaper of a black man who's being charged with first degree murder of an eighth grader, and that black man happens to have dreadlocks, and you repeat that picture thousands of times, you know, a year over in the media, over a significant number of years, hundreds of years perhaps, in our society, then we will start to associate dreadlocks with violence.
Well, in a society where image is dictated by white people, because, you know, where I come from, dreadlocks are a spiritual and religious,
mm-hmm.
you know, dress and, you know, the way you wear your hair. I mean, I think, you know, we're trying to find excuses, and we're accepting the system's excuses for snuffing out a people, you know, simple as that. I mean, you know, it's kind of interesting that we're talking, on the one hand, we're talking about, you know, the police force killing black men, and then at another point, we're talking about what people wear, you know. And it's funny because, I mean, really, honestly, a suit and a tie just allows you to commit bigger crimes. You know, I mean, you know, I don't think a kid that was sagging and wearing a hoodie, you know, had anything to do with, you know, with Wall Street and had anything to do with, you know, kicking people out of their homes and, you know, devastating entire communities. I mean, it's you know.
CJ, did you have a comment? We've got
a
caller.
Well, on the other hand, I feel like, I mean, I would never vilify someone because of what they wore, but I as a college-educated person, I am the type of person who believes that in a certain way of doing things, in a certain look sometimes, and I'm not opposed to that. To saying that, you know, if I want to be a lawyer, I need to look like a lawyer. I need to be presentable for court because I represent other people when I'm doing things like that. And to the peer pressure, it all does exist. All of that stuff does exist. When I was in high school, I wore FUBU because that was what was in. You dress the part or you will be made fun of. But I don't think that's specifically a black-specific kind of thing. I don't want to stress that only blacks deal with this kind of peer pressure. If you saw Mean Girls, then you know everybody deals with it. What's specific to the black culture is the vilification of these attributes and that they're not just attributed to young black men, but black men in general. So a young black man with dreads will be just as vilified for having his dreads as a 45-year-old black man with dreads.
But so let me ask you this about age. And I think, is age a factor in how people are being perceived? So if you're saying if you have Bill Cosby prior to whatever's been going on now, sagging with dreadlocks, he's going to be viewed differently than the 18-year-old dressed in the same way?
Yeah, I definitely think so. If you even want to look at, like, we talked about Tamir Rice, the smear campaign that came after, he was no longer a 12-year-old boy. He lived in a neighborhood saturated in violence. His family had violent issues beforehand. There's a smear campaign that goes on when the younger the child is. You have to actually kind of age him up to where that you can actually understand and believe why this could happen. I think that America as a culture needs to inherently understand why bad things happen, and they want, in order for that to happen, when a black person is killed, you have to vilify them. Michael Brown was stealing. He was doing this, and that's why he had to be shot.
We have a caller on the line. Caller, what's your name and where are you calling from?
This is Kay from Midtown Kansas City, and getting some really good comments from your guests and callers. What I see as the root of this problem is government impunity. This ability of people on the government payroll to act as they see fit against their own procedures, against their own ordinance, and they can't be gotten off that payroll.
Well, caller, thank you very much for your call, and let me ask you guys to address that. I mean, in this respect, you know, where do we go from here? Meaning, to me, I believe there is a solution, and it would take a significant period of time, but the problem has arisen over hundreds of years, so we can't expect tomorrow to be the answer. But I guess in my own personal development, which continues up until this moment in meeting both of you, is it seems to be education, almost getting individuals to be thirsty for knowledge, and then giving them access to that knowledge and the ability to process that knowledge. If I can say there's an answer to me, that seems to be it. What's your response to that, CJ?
That's definitely the answer. You have to know what's happening around you. I think that there's a level of pacification that comes around with with the passion of affirmative action, with all the strides that we made in the Civil Rights Act, and then you got this level of comfort because we started to achieve, we started to move into suburbs, we started to gain things, and through that we started to become less politically active, we were less thirsty for it because we started to get something. And I think that there's this kind of false feeling that there are no race issues, there's this false feeling that we've made it, and like, the struggle is ongoing. It's as disparaging as the 1%. The 1% amongst black is like the 0.001%. And we are no longer politically active. We're no longer politically inclusive. We have the right to vote, and it's protected, and will not go. We will not make that extra effort. People sit in lines for days. They fought and stood and bled. If you watched Selma, you saw that. They tried to break up this man's marriage in order to stop this from happening, and yet people will not get off their butts and register. They will not get up their butts and vote. I mean, we need to continue to press for education, political activism, and political inclusion, and make sure that everybody is in it and doing their part. That's the best thing we can do to elicit change.
And zero profit. What is your thought?
Yeah, I think we need a re-education process, but I think we also need to understand that this white system also teaches white people who are poor that black folks are their enemy in order to keep white people who are poor believing that their enemy is black people and not the system itself.
Sure, and so and that goes to more of an underpinning, which I've wondered, just I'm wondering out loud, is, you know, is race just a system created to almost as a red herring? What's really going on is economics.
Yeah,
that's
no,
what's
exactly.
Really, that's what's really going on, but we need to make it so we get that we're saying poor whites is what you're saying, say, hey, don't worry about your economic situation, at least you're better than blacks, mm-hmm. when in fact whites have more in common with the blacks.
Yeah, and you know, and black folks are the ones that are, you know, bringing this fungus of baggy pants and hoodies into the communities of white children, you know. Yeah, so it's, I mean, totally, but I mean, you propped up slavery by creating the construct of race so that you could justify enslaving somebody mm-hmm. based on their race.
So let me ask you this, guys, to both of you. Zero profit, you're going to go back to New York to East Harlem or Bronx, right? You're going to go back to UMKC, mm-hmm. right? I'm going to go back down to my law firm mm-hmm. down at downtown and then back out to my house in Johnson County. So after we hug it out today, what do? I mean, how do we continue this forward other than a radio show where the three of us are sitting around a table? Where would the three of us interact again in this manner and have this type of discussion? I can't tell you that. I don't know where. What do you guys think?
I mean, we do what we can. We continue to build the network. Every person that listens today, every person we talk to when we go back to UMKC, every brick that we can knock down on this fight is a step in the right direction and taking that brick down off the wall and putting it on the road. I am very hopeful with my experiences with people that I have that we tear down these kinds of restrictions on what we can do. I have made great strides in convincing other people. I feel like that's the work that needs to be done and that I will continue to do.
Thank you. And Zero Profit, what about yourself?
I mean, one thing I you know, love or hate hip-hop culture, it is one of the few cultures, if not the only culture, that crosses across borders, across barriers, across barbed wire to reach all kinds of folks. So, I mean, for me, I've been trying to talk in schools, and I've been trying to talk on the street, and I've been trying to build on the street and try to reach people where they're at and get away from all the, you know, all the professorial-type conversations and just talk about what's going on.
And you've got actually two things coming up I want to mention. Is it Machetero, a movie that you've produced, you made, that's being played Sunday, February 7th at 6 p.m. at the Q, 3504 Woodland. Again, Sunday, February 7th, 6 p.m., the Q at 3504 Woodland in Kansas City, Missouri. And then also you have a hip-hop workshop, which is going to take place Sunday, the 24th of February, from 4 to 6 p.m., 3909 Main Street at Like Me Lighthouse. And you'll be running that workshop, is that right?
Yeah.
And again, that's the hip-hop workshop, Sunday, 24th of February, 4 to 6 p.m., 3909 Main Street at Like Me Lighthouse. I want to take a caller real quick, and then we'll close up with some comments. Caller, you're on the phone. What is your name, and where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm Brianna in Kansas City, and I'm curious to hear what y'all would have to say about how voting affects a system where slavery is still legal. Like, the 13th Amendment says slavery is legal as punishment for a crime. So if slavery is still legal in this country, how can we vote effectively enough to fix that?
Thank you, caller.
I think
let me take that question a little bit and move it a little bit forward in that it seems to me one of the things you may be talking about is the extent to which slavery is no longer legal. There is the right to vote. However, we have a criminal justice system. When someone's convicted of a felony, then that vote is taken away right away. So we're back to the same situation that we started from. CJ, you have any comments about that?
I think that, I mean, the amount of lies that we're willing to believe are we have to, like, bring things to the truth and to the light, I think, more effectively. I think that you deal with a lot of red tape when it comes to laws, politics, and things like that, and that we just need to, you know, work harder at bringing out the facts and going with that. I don't know if there's still a slavery system in which she was – I didn't understand what she meant by that, but I suppose, like, when it comes to, like, voting and, like, vilifying men and then taking away their right to vote, I think that's an issue. And I think that the best thing that we can do is fight. Like, if we have a problem with that, we need to lobby and fight and try to get things like that overturned where we can maybe get certain crimes devilified and taken off that list. Because the petty way that they do drug crimes and they take away a man's vote and he only had 6 months to 3 years in jail is just crazy.
Zero profit.
Well, I think we need more community empowerment, and we think we need to start looking at other alternatives to voting, and we need to start looking at, you know, as Malcolm said, nearly 50 years ago, the ballot or the bullet, or maybe the ballot or the boombox. But we definitely need to start thinking differently and seeing things differently and taking different action. That's probably a whole other conversation.
And you've got a website, do you not, Zero Profit? Is it agitrap.com?
Yes, it's agitrap.com.
Agitrap.com. CJ, do you have anything coming up at any of your student organizations that you're working on that if I talk about? If not, that's okay, but now's the time to do it. You know, I really want to take the moment to thank both of you for coming. This has been a great – I was excited about it when I knew that both of you were coming in after I got a chance to talk to both of you, and I think it's been – a really wonderful show. And if you have any comments about the show, you're able to go to our website at KKFI at 90.1 and leave comments. There is a space for Jaws of Justice. In addition, if you would like to listen to this show or our show a few weeks ago or any other show, you can go to the website and download or stream the same. We really appreciate everyone calling in today, and we appreciate everyone listening, and thank you again to Zero Profit and to CJ, and we'll look forward to talking to you next time on Jaws of Justice.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following segment comes to us courtesy of The Hill, a Washington, D.C. newspaper. It features an interview with our president, Barack Obama.
So sometimes people think I do, but I don't smoke pot. And it just is not for me. I think that it's bad for my brain. I'm not into it, but people think I do smoke pot because I'm in favor of legalizing marijuana. And we're in a really weird place with marijuana right now. Like, it's illegal in some places, but it's illegal everywhere, but in some places it's kind of okay. But if the state thinks it's not okay, then let's throw those people in jail. I feel like it leads to excessive incarceration, especially among minorities. And in places where it's been legalized, everything's doing okay.
Yeah.
How do we move forward out of this legal gray area weirdness?
Well, what you're seeing now is Colorado, Washington, through state referendum, they're experimenting with legal marijuana. The position of my administration has been that we still have federal laws that classify marijuana as a illegal substance, but we're not going to spend a lot of resources trying to turn back decisions that have been made at the state level on this issue. My suspicion is that you're going to see other states start looking at this. What I am doing at the federal level is asking my Department of Justice just to examine generally how we are treating nonviolent drug offenders. Because I think you're right. What we have done is, instead of focusing on treatment, the same way we focused, say, with tobacco or drunk driving or other problems where we treat it as a public health problem, we've treated this exclusively as a criminal problem. And I think that it's been counterproductive, and it's been devastating in a lot of minority communities. It presents the possibility, at least, of unequal application of the law, and that has to be changed. Now, the good news is that we're starting to get some interest among Republicans as well as Democrats in reforming the criminal justice system. We've been able to initiate some changes administratively, and last year you had the first time in 40 years where the crime rate and the incarceration rate went down at the same time. I hope we can continue with those trends because there's just a smarter way of dealing with these issues.
Perhaps the president finally got around to reading my book, but in any case, it seems that he and his attorney general are taking a good look at this drug war and seeing there's a lot of room for change. I just wish they'd paid more attention to the first chapter, Incrementalism is a Killer. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.
Ready? One, two, three. We'll be right back.
my problem. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.
Teach myself.